through the redemption of the metals, through the regeneration of the metals. Now the soul principle, as represented by Mercury, is not only the individual soul, but the world soul. So if we wish to take the old Trinitarian concept, the sun is God, salt is the Holy Ghost, and Mercury is the Christ power, the universal soul. And Mercury as Christ, the catalyst, says, "None go unto the Father save by me." In other words, everything that ascends from a material to a spiritual state must pass through soul culture or soul power. And it is in this soul power, which is represented by one of the alchemical retorts, that by the heat of purification, the base elements are withdrawn, or caused to pass off, or are incinerated, leaving only the spiritual agent or essence. Man, therefore, does not grow by what happens to him, but by what he does about what happens to him. And this calls upon the power of his own consciousness. You could see easily how what we call realization corresponds with Mercury. Because in realization, the individual is capable of accepting everything into the experience of consciousness and transforming it into truth. Realization is the discovery of the universal in everything, and that is in itself a complete act of catalyzing. So the soul of man, consisting of two parts, the rational part and the instinctual part, is Mercury. And in this mercurial agent, the great wonders of alchemy are performed. And in the symbol of Mercury, you have the cross, the circle, and the crescent, brought together in the planetary symbol and in the chemical symbol of Mercury. John Dee, the great English mystic and statesman, wrote a complete book called The Hieroglyphical Monad, which is devoted entirely to the study of the symbol of Mercury. Because Mercury and its alchemical meaning practically is the key to the entire story of modern psychology. Now we have, therefore, spirit, will, the great power of the king. We have the infinite unknown, the tremendous negative power of the queen. Because without the queen, this power never releases itself, never manifests itself. And we have equilibrium established between these two, which is Mercury. Therefore, Mercury becomes equilibrium, balance. And in the alchemical symbols, we frequently find Mercury holding a pair of scales. It is the equilibrium of forces. For by bringing spirit and matter into equilibrium, the positive accomplishment of the soul is assured. Now in this same symbolism, therefore, Mercury becomes the first and greatest of the adepts, because Mercury is Hermes Trismegistus, the thrice great Hermes, the symbol of the absolute embodiment of all wisdom, in whose name the Hermetic arts were brought into existence. Hermes, as the thaumaturgic adept, is consequently the appropriate and proper symbol of the adept soul in man. Now the adept soul is the soul which is born again of the union of the king and queen. But this union of the king and queen is by art or nature, and not by the primary generation. For when the adept has accomplished the hermetic marriage, or the reunion of the king and queen within himself, through the instrumentality of Hermes, he is then the adept king. Now this is as much as saying that he has restored the Holy Empire. He has restored, as a philosopher king in Greece, the balance and equilibrium of his own existence. He is able, therefore, to bind or to hold or to unite within his own nature, in a condition of suspension, the two great opposites of existence, spirit and matter. Now, in doing these very interesting things, the adept symbol itself appears. Now, the adept is usually represented also as two-headed, often by the two-headed eagle, which is his proper emblem. The two-headed eagle, in this case, being, of course, a gradual derivation from the original Egyptian phoenix, which was the true eagle. The adept as the two-headed eagle has, therefore, the same symbolism as the androgyne king-queen, the Ishvara, the male-female principle in suspension, the two-headed king-queen, representing the divine power of the Atman itself, is reflected into the adept, who has accomplished the same equilibrium again by will and yoga, or by effort, within his own nature. Now, the adept in the Hermetic symbols, of course, is the hero self, to whom all the adventures occur, and whose labor it is forever and eternally to restore the mystery. Thus we have your alchemical symbolism reaching out into practically every different group of fables that we know. St. George and the Dragon. St. George is the adept. The dragon that he is overcoming is the dragon of chaos, the dragon of disorientation, disorganization, confusion, ignorance. And your adept king, of course, is Sindad the Sailor, performing his 12 mysterious voyages into the unknown and having great and wonderful adventures. The adept king is Hercules, performing the 12 labors. Samson, carrying away the gates of Geza. The adept king is also Melchizedek, the Prince of Salem. Wherever the great and wonderful wise one appears, as the man symbol, is the adept king. The adept king is always the glorified Hermes. He rules with the scepter of the king and queen of the sun and moon. He is the third of the great lights, for the sun and moon and man are the great lights of the mysteries. Now, with this basic symbolism, we can see how the alchemist could proceed with certain mystical speculation. What other symbols immediately present themselves to our attention? We have to have the symbol of chaos. We have to have the symbol of the thing that must be overcome. And therefore, we extend our thinking on the subject of base metals, which represent to a degree the chaos. Therefore, it is not impossible for us to recognize the meaning of seeing a great stormy sea, in the midst of which is an ark, like the Ark of Noah, and on the deck of the ark, an alchemical bottle. In other words, the alchemy floating on the sea of chaos. The Ark of Noah, which contains within itself all the germs of life for the replenishment of the earth, is an alchemical symbol, if you want to see it. Then we have also, in another case, the bottle in the ark, with the dove flying out of it, carrying a little bit of green in its beak. The dove is an alchemical symbol in this case. We have accepted it as a symbol of promise, as a symbol of the restoration of faith and of peace and of the return of life to the world. But the dove is an alchemical emblem. Wherever it appears, it is a soul symbol. Now, in another kind of alchemy, we can have monsters, griffins of all kinds. But your base substance, your purity, your corrupt material from which all of these things are derived, must always represent crude matter, or its equivalent, crude, undeveloped consciousness within a living thing, this consciousness existing in a state of total ignorance. Now, if you will go back to the legends of the Trojan War, you will find the references to the ancient city of Elim, which comes from the word Elis, meaning slime or mud, from which all things are supposed to have come forth in the beginning of life. Even science is inclined to take a little bad attitude in the generation of living things, but they came out of primordial ooze, mud, or the slime of a prehistoric world. Therefore, in alchemy, we have a monster, a strange lizard-like thing, not the salamander of fire, but a strange creature that lives in ooze and mud and corruption. A kind of a behemoth, a leviathan, that must be attacked by Murdoch and slain with the sword of light and will. Here we have also Fafna in the Nordic mythology, sleeping and guarding the cave of the Nibelungen traitor. And his only remark is, let me sleep. The dragon of chaos. Then, as you watch this dragon of chaos, you see Lincoln, or Merodach, or Tammuz, or whichever one of the deities you wish to think, Adonis, all of them, coming down with the sword, armed with light, bearing the shield of power, and slaying the dragon of chaos. So let's think just for a moment now of what this might possibly mean. Probably most of us have never taken a very careful examination of our own psychological interiors. We do not realize that in extraordinary instances, each one of us has within us a substratum of negative psychic material, which is this elos, or slime. This slime, or corruption within our own psychic life, which is forever breeding and sustaining and nourishing this dark monster, this monster of negation, which is the root of the negative impulses of all man's psychic activity. And so the individual, bringing the sword of light and striking into the dark mystery of his own subjective, slay the negative monster that lurks there, is Mercury, performing one of his great alchemical labors, of which there are many. Though if the elus, or the slime, the corruption of things, is represented in this way, there is another very interesting symbolism that has to come into this particular purpose. And that is the symbol of death. In alchemy, the symbol of death is found in the bottles. We see the metals calcinated. We see things which, unless they die, cannot be born again. So that as the seed cannot live unless first it dies, so in alchemy, all liberation is death. And everything is released by death. The alchemical formula on this is rather important, so we'll pause for a moment to try to estimate it a little bit. All things in a living state are locked. The consciousness within a form is locked by that form completely. It can never break through that form without first reducing the form. Alchemy does not assume that it is possible for a structure containing a compound of ignorance and wisdom, that is, pure and base metal, can be taken at any particular point and immediately advanced to a superior state. Everything that seeks to grow by alchemy must first die. Because while it is in a state of generation, its parts are inseparable and cannot be divided. During life, consciousness and body cannot be divided. By death only are they divided. So alchemy says that only by the phenomenon of death can the metal be divided from their base and their subtle parts. Now this doesn't mean, the alchemist certainly did not mean, that an individual who is separated, his baser and better parts must go out and shoot himself. They did not mean that in any sense of the word. What they meant was that all growth comes from the dying of something. Or you can have a new idea, an old one hasn't died. You cannot accept an idea if you are satisfied with the one you have. If you want to grow, you've got to give up something. If you want to proceed, the past must die. If you want to be more than you are, something that is less must perish along the way. You cannot start upon this great search bound and locked within the structure of your own opinion. Your opinions have to die before there's any room in you for truth. Everything has to be reduced to its essentials. And the essential of everything is seed and ashes. Seed and ashes, says the alchemist. The seed that cannot die, which is the king, and the ashes which must die. So everything must be reduced by putrefaction, by the disintegration of its parts, to essential material. For, says the alchemist, all of the metals in their essential nature will combine to form the stone or the medicine. But once the metals have bodies, they can never combine. So material gold, material silver, and material copper will never combine. The only way you can combine them is through the agent of mercury, which destroys their bodies and releases their principles. Or, as the alchemist would like to put it more correctly, if you take these spirits out of bodies, the spirits will unite, but the bodies cannot. So the same of man. The essential life principles of all creatures are compatible, but their personalities and their vehicles of manifestation are not compatible. Thus, all things in their purity can be united. And all things in their impurity cannot be united. As the alchemist also says, at the beginning of things, all was one. At the end of things, all will be one. In the middle distance between beginning and end, there will be many. And while the state of many exists, this manyness can never be brought together. The only way in which many can become one again is to have the vehicles or bodies destroyed. The principles have always been one. But as long as these principles are locked within symbolic forms, these forms will never unite. They may come near together, but they can never perform at the alchemy of fusing or becoming identical or to lose themselves in a new substance. And here is again one of the great secrets of alchemy. The seven metals, or the seven substances, representing the testimonies of the seven senses and the seven powers of the soul, when they unite in the soul, they produce something entirely separate and different from themselves. And H2O does not represent H2 or O separately, but produces a new thing, differing in appearance and essential nature from its own parts. So in alchemy, when the seven metals are brought together, they do not produce a lump of seven metals. They produce a new being, completely different. And when the compound is correctly measured and estimated, the result is an entirely new being, separate and distinct, in which there is no longer any trace of the parts which made it. If you bring the material substances together by artificial means and form a statue with them, you can always divide them again under heat or under something. Under some means. That mercury will usually divide them again. But in alchemy, when the seven essences have been brought together, there is an entirely new existence created. And that new existence is different from anything that preceded it. And this thing that is created by the alchemy of the union of matters is actually the human soul. And the human soul was called the Logos, or the crystal child, that is born out of the alchemical retort, the great glass womb of chemistry. For it is the purpose of alchemy to create a living thing. This living thing, or the homunculus, is a generation of art and nature. And the alchemist who performs this mystery plays God, for he creates. Now, he will tell you himself that alchemy is nothing more nor less than man's keen observation of natural process. The man watching, as Paracelsus watched, the miners at work, the mines of the Fugas, watching the processes, studying the way in which coal and diamonds come into existence. Or in China, the mystery of amber, locking within itself the tiny insect from the prehistoric world. Man studying nature discovers the mystery of soul. Now in this mystery, which is called in alchemy the homunculus, we have the same mystery that is called in Chinese metaphysics the transcendent being. And the homunculus is the new creature that is formed out of the seven souls or seven natures of man. Just as surely as he generates his kind by male and female, by the union of the king and queen, as a psychic and spiritual power within his own nature, so he generates himself, or generates a being out of himself, which is called the homunculus, and has its parallel in the story of Melchizedek, who was his own father and his own mother, if you remember, the Prince of Peace. Now this being that is its own father and its own mother is adequately and properly represented in alchemy by one of the supreme symbols of the achievement, and that is the phoenix. Because the phoenix is the bird which gives birth to itself out of itself. So the phoenix, which lives for 500 years, according to the Egyptian legend, came to the time when it must die. It retired to an altar of flame in one of the temples, and there in a nest of fire its body broke open and the new phoenix issued from it, and there was never but one phoenix alive at a time. Now this is alchemical symbolism with a vengeance, and it tells us a great deal, because this phoenix allegory returns to us again in China. The phoenix, of course, is the self-generated being in which the seven powers of the metals, having been invaded by a process of generation, create within themselves an immortal being. So in the story of mankind, you know the gods and you know mortals. So you know the gods live forever and mortals have their sorrows for a day. There's a story in India about some people who live in the Nilgiri Hills who belong to a community or a nation or a race in which nobody is ever born. Now that's a kind of a curious thought, because this little community is composed of persons born everywhere who go there for certain reasons. Therefore, no one's born there theoretically. It is a race that is composed of persons who have certain peculiarities or distinction about themselves, coming from anywhere, because they are alike in this mysterious manner, go there. Now this legend, and certain of the factors involved in it, is again very much the story. You know the hero is a very, very interesting being. You know, in the legends and the myths about these beings, we have something that is very strange to us. Something that is born and never dies. Now that breaks most of the rules of common sense. It is well known to the old days of theological doubts and misgivings as the famous Methodist one-ended stick. You hear them talk about that whenever theological controversies get warm. Someone is born as a beginning, then goes on forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever. whether here in heaven or below. Something that has a beginning in time has no end in eternity. It becomes a sort of a one-ended stick. It's quite a controversial issue. Well, then actually, there is a one-ended stick. And that one-ended stick is the homunculus, the soul power, the soul being. Because the soul is something that has a beginning, but no end. And Bainey was one of the first to recognize this interesting and remarkable phenomenon. Your soul, as the adept came, is generated within man by the mingling and chemistry of intuition and reason, of wisdom and love, and of the polarities of the soul power in their form of the king and queen. The soul, therefore, has its own world ruled over by the king who is wisdom and the queen who is love. And wisdom, the king, is the master of the show, and he is always seeking the unknown, love, which is the queen, and without which he cannot fulfill himself. So here again, you can take love away from him, you can capture the queen on the chessboard, but again, you cannot capture the king. All these symbols refer back again. But in the soul, wisdom and love unite to produce a being. And this being has a beginning, but no end. And this being is the source of immortality. Because the king and the queen, spirit and matter, are not bound together by an eternal union. They must always be the result of a compound. And as Lord Bacon asked to have inscribed upon his tomb, let all compounds be dissolved. Life and matter are polarities of each other. And their relations to each other are eternally impermanent. Therefore, spirit and matter meet and separate. And that which is purely of its own nature returns to itself. And that which is of an opposing nature returns to its own source. The thing that binds them is virtue, the homunculus, or the hermetic adept. And it is the adept then, or the adept self, the transcendent being of China, that creates its own immortality by binding its own seven souls together into one immortal being. And this progeny of the sun and moon, of heaven and earth, of spirit and matter, is born by art, but never dies. Because that is man's earned immortality, or earned eternal existence. He exists eternally as spirit and matter forever. Nothing can ever stop that. But he exists eternally as a conscious being only when he creates the soul, or creates or perfects the great alchemical experience. Now, in Eastern philosophy, they would go even further than that. They would say that once having created the adept soul, that even that must ultimately renounce its own immortality. And therefore, again, the hero of the world dies always, usually in the service of great love, searching again for the unknown queen. The symbolism is very adroitly used. It is exceedingly subtle. You can draw some tremendous tapestries with it, always because of the wonderful interworking of rules and principles and laws. But the soul, now, which is St. Paul's wedding garment, the soul is the eternal or immortal self, the transcendent being, born of the marriage of heaven and earth. It is, however, not merely man as a form or structure. Primitive man is building the soul. The soul began to build when man was created. And step by step, it has taken over the inner control of him. And so today he is controlled by his emotions and his thoughts, which are the present developed state of the soul. But, says alchemy, in this method, by nature alone, the path is very long, and along the way the soul has been very sick. It has become utterly confused, and the path of its final restoration by nature means that man must slowly work out through trial and error, through joy and sorrow, through life and death, every inconsistency of his own psychic life. This project suggests millions of years. It suggests thousands of lives, perhaps, to day by day, step by step, exhaust the errors of the soul and experience every good thing in spite of our effort to evade, in spite of our own resistance to grow, a resistance which itself must gradually be overcome through a great series of time and sorrow. So alchemy says, art will perfect nature. Man becoming a priest in the great chemical laboratory of the universe will cooperate voluntarily and will assist nature in the perfection of the soul. So it says to the individual, very much as Mercury, the Christos, the anointing oil, the symbol of the transmutation, says that if you would be the disciple of truth, be as a little child. Here is Mercury destroying the metals. Here is the sword breaking up the patterns. Here is the death of an old self, the death of an opinionation which we have long called ourselves. The acceptance of the fact that we are ignorant, but we think we are wise, which is the death of ego. And that's one of the most magnificent extinctions of all. One of the most difficult to attain. So here also stands a figure, the villain of the play, with the mortgage in one hand, the symbol of the ego, which in the alchemical art is always present as a kind of adversary, as a kind of power that seeks to destroy the work. So the destruction of the great work, of the great adept experiment by the ego comes into consideration. And the villain plays his role to try to prevent the consummation of the magnum opus. But the work of the creation of the seventh soul, or the soul of life, goes on in the alchemical mystery. In Ashmole's The Artum Chemicum Criterium, which is one of the great English collections of alchemical works, we have the horoscope of the great work, showing the moment in time of the birth of the adept king, his nativity properly calculated. Another book, equally interesting, has the original, true, and undoubtable horoscope of Adam. It is quite conceivable. Not because we have the slightest idea of when Adam was born, and ever will, but Adamus is another name for the base metal, and the base substances from which the metals are taken. So we find Adam appearing in the alchemical retort. We have Eve appearing in the alchemical retort. Adam is again the king, and Eve is the mystery, the eternal quest of the unknown. So in the alchemical rites also, we find the restoration of the Virgin Sophia from the Gnosis, and from the great systems of wisdom. And we have in the chemical marriage of Christian Rosenkreutz, the Virgin Lucifera, the mysterious soul counterpart of Lucifer. These are all alchemically used symbols. But they all tell us of the creation of the soul power, which is the victory of man. There is one very interesting symbolism which I have seen in alchemy. There is a series of 64 bottles, which is an interesting number because it corresponds exactly with the development of the Chinese trigrams. In each of these 64 bottles is an episode from the life of Christ, forming a perfect circle. And here, in these episodes from the life of Christ, each incident is marked with the alchemical symbols. so that you will know exactly what is referred to. And the theory behind the whole concept is that Christ is this imperishable seventh soul, the power of immortality. And that that individual who follows in the way indicated, who takes up the cross and follows the Master through the 64 augmentations of the material, as it is called, will also achieve the resurrection. And in the last bottle, as a symbol of the consummation of the great work, the creation of the divine soul, we see the figure of Christ carrying the banner on the staff, rising in the midst of life from the grave, the resurrection. And this resurrection is the rebirth of the Phoenix. The entire cycle reminds us of Paul's words, the Christ in you, which is the hope of glory. For to the alchemist, Christ is the symbol of the soul, the mystery of the soul that is born in a manger, surrounded by beasts, the soul that must pass through certain vicissitudes, be crucified and die, and be raised from the dead before it can live again. And exactly what occurs in that allegory is told in the story of the death and resurrection of the seed in the ground. For this is the parable. The seed is the word of God. And alchemy says, the seeds of the metals are the seeds of immortality. In this way, the soul mystery in alchemy is unfolded at its true purpose, the integration of the soul as a living vehicle within which a new being, the Son of Heaven and Earth, can have a real and conscious life. This is the adept self, the reborn, the twice or thrice born Hermes. In this same symbolism, we come across a number of other very intriguing things for thought. We have the tree of the metals. We have the Saturn, Cronus, the old one-legged gardener walking on a crutch. And we have him carefully watering the tree upon which grow the seven metals in the form of flowers and fruit. This is the tree of alchemy. This is also represented in another form as a tree with 12 bears bearing a fruit upon it, in this case, watered by the same old man, with the opposite leg crippled, and this time the tree bearing on it the 12 signs of the zodiac as fruit. The 12 signs of the zodiac, incidentally, represent the 12 steps or mutations which are repeated in cycles to produce the augmentation of the stone. For the stone at the beginning is very weak, and it must be repeatedly augmented, cycle after cycle, until it increases in strength. This is because man, in the practice of truth, is at first very weak and infirm. But by continuous repetition, or the continuous recollection of reality, it constantly increases within himself through the contemplative disciplines. It's the same thing exactly. So we have two trees, one with seven levels and one with 12 signs of the zodiac. And one is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which is the tree of the birth. And the other is the tree of life, which bears the 12 manner of fruit, which are for the healings of the nations. And if you will look down at the bottom of the tree of life, you will find lying in the ground beneath it, the king and queen buried together, and from their body the tree rising. Because from the union of heaven and earth rises the tree of life. But the tree of the metals, or the soul, the seven blossoms on that tree, are watered and taken care of by Saturn, the old god of contemplation, the punisher, the destroyer, the principle of karma, the retribution, and discipline, the old one-legged gardener, is self-discipline, by which the tree of the soul is caused to bear its fruit. So each little story is a little gem in itself, telling things about all these moral mysteries. But with it all, let us not forget that Roger Bacon is said to have gone to the King of England and offered to finance by a man-made gold the crusade. Gold was made. Now, how and why was gold made? the gold makers actually did cause the precipitation of metals. And there are examples in European museums, some of which I esteem, of man-made gold. Not made at the expense of $50,000 an ounce. That's why we try to do something of that kind by our presence. Scientifically, we can make gold, but not on a profitable basis. Of course, it goes up much higher, so it gets to be profitable. The reason why the alchemist was able to make gold was because he had learned something. He had learned that the same power which makes soul operates on an archetype. That the soul represents an artificial gold, a synthetic gold, and that it can be manufactured as man manufactures his own destiny. And in the same way, by the same laws, the metals, the physical metals, can be handled. But in order to handle them, as Nicholas Flamel points out, you must kill the metals. You must actually perform the physical strain, the death and resurrection of the metals. You kill the metals. You take copper, iron, tin, mercury. You take these and you learn how to absolutely destroy them. And when you have completely destroyed them, you have released by that means from them a universal essence which permeates them all. Then, if you know how, you can restore that pattern according to the element that you desire. But you cannot do it while iron is iron, or zinc is zinc, or copper is copper. It must first be reduced to a common denominator. And the discovery of the common denominator applies to many things. Today we have a problem in connection with common denominators. When we have Japanese and Chinese and Hindus and Greeks and Persians and Jews, we are never going to have brotherhood of man. We can. But we can only have that brotherhood of man when we destroy the differences and discover the reality. We have got to go back and down through and remove all these layers of separateness and find the unity, and then build upon it, we will have one people. That's the same principle exactly as the alchemical experiment. We cannot take things in their various degrees of development and synthesize them. You've got to reduce them to their basic principle. That's why we practically have to reduce the human being to extremity before we teach him anything. It is only when he says to himself, I am a complete failure, that he begins to have a little hope of succeeding. When he says to himself, I don't know what to do next, then he will begin to think. Because he has reduced himself to his basic element by rejecting and renouncing his own confusion and error. So in alchemy and in all departments, including chemistry itself, the reduction of these elements to their basic element makes possible their restoration in a new and important integration or into a new chemical substance, which can be augmented then by cycles until its particular purpose is attained. Gold can be made. And it is no more ridiculous than saying soul can be made. And yet most people do not believe or realize that a soul can be made. They believe they have it. That it's something that is conferred upon it. And yet the culture, development, perfection of the soul is one of the greatest of all the arts. And in alchemy, the soul is tremendously important, because it becomes the living body of the being. It becomes the basis of the being born from itself, the old man who dies in darkness and is born in light. So we have an interesting situation arise. The king is said to die, the king being spirit, the divine power. The king died. And why does the king die? Because he is slain by an evil power, the ogre,
which of course is chaos, confusion. The absolute absorption of the king into the universe, or life completely absorbed in phenomena, and thereby no longer recognizable in its own nature. But the king comes to life again through his own son, or in his own son. And you go right back to your legend of Osiris, the Egyptian ritual. You will find in Plutarch's description of the death and resurrection of Osiris, that after the death of Osiris, he overshadowed as a holy spirit his sister wife, Isis, and she bare Horus, the symbol of the messianic soul. And when the child was born, her own brother husband entered into the body of the child. Therefore, he was his own father, certainly, in that particular case. This child was a widow's son, because he was born after his father had deserted. And this child, Horus, was not the son of his father only, but was his father by a mystery of transubstantiation. Therefore, Horus, or Christ, says, "Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. For the Father is in me, and I am in the Father, and the Father and I are one." And that was held to be an implication that Jesus, as a human being, considered himself God, which was not the implication at all. But the soul, virtue, becomes the embodiment of his own Father. The divine power of heaven, which is spirit, reborn through soul, becomes the new being, the new king of heaven and earth. And this new king is the perfected or enlightened or redeemed resurrected man, in whom all the mysteries of the universe have been perfected in the marriage of the metals, which are the parts or the symbols of all the structures that go together to form the vehicle of the soul. This is again the famous garment of glory of the high priests of Israel. For each of the garments, the breastplate, the Urim and Thummim, and all the vestments represent the adornments and jewels of the soul. Here also is the ecclesia of the early Christian dispensation, the church. For if you remember that it is the church adorned as a bride who is united in eternal marriage to the Lamb. The church adorned as a flower, as a bride, is of course a symbol of man's assembly of parts, or the psychic nature with its reunion with God. So the symbolism goes on and on. And in alchemy we have a book which is called the Book Sealed with Seven Seals, which is based upon the Book of Revelation and unfolds all the mysteries of Revelation under the seals of the seven metals. We have all these emblems used constantly and inevitably to reveal one story, namely that man must create his own immortal soul by art. That this soul is the diamond of the mind, and that who builds a soul builds an imperishable self that has a new being, and the old man passes away and the new man comes. And in this new being, the adept self, man claims his immortality, because he can be separated into parts, and so he fuses these parts himself into the great psychic entity which is called the soul, which then becomes his real self, is born from him as a transcendent being, and gradually gains an existence apart from him. And there's the mysterious Megas, or the mysterious Rishi, the great wonder worker, the Mahatma. For the great soul is the reborn soul, made of the seven souls, described in Egypt. And if you want to know the meaning of the elements and the metals, you will find that the seven elements of the soul used in alchemy are found in Egypt, where they form part of one section of the Book of the Dead. But it is the combining of the seven souls that perish to form the one imperishable soul, which is the atomic soul, or the soul of the magician, the wonder worker, who becomes his own father, who is reborn through his own son, who becomes the symbol of the true Hermes, the Adamkin, and in him all that was and is and ever shall be is resurrected. And he is then the beloved son, and he is the prodigal son who has returned to his father's house. All these symbols tie together in one terrific pattern. Next week we'll do some more with them, but I'm afraid if we do much more tonight, you'll never get all these patterns on.